Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hola amigos y como están? Sorry, hold on, hit the SAP button. Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. Hey, I'm Hispanic, so I can do that. Don't even look at me like that. Do not give me that look. My wife will approve. I'm trying out the
All I have to say is I'm glad I didn't do what I was about to do, which was to try to like duplicate your sound with the hello, but that would have just really sounded confusing.
Oh yeah, yeah. I would have loved to see you try to even imitate.
Oh, I can
it
do
least.
It. I can do it. I oh, yeah? choose not to. This is power held in reserve.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is what you're in store for today. So, of course, I am your host, Eddie Van Weva. Alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi.
Hi.
Hola! Right? See, I can do it. I can do it.
It almost seemed like you were falling down a well. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a great show in store for you today. We're going to be talking about a lot of awesome stuff that we've actually been talking about here off air. We've been talking about here as far as summer releases, summer blockbusters. And, you know, we're going to get into that. We're going to discuss a little bit about what it means to be a summer blockbuster.
I know we're shedding tears because the summer season is coming to an end.
It is. You know, school's coming back into session. Kids are going back to school, having to get up early. I'm sadly still having to get up early because I work, so I don't go to school.
The sun's going to be coming up later and going down earlier and all that craziness that happens in the wintertime. I'm not ready for that.
I don't think anybody is. When school is back in session, The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. Remember, you can subscribe to The Filmlosophers podcast on your favorite platforms and download previous episodes from Stitcher, Player FM, Google Play, iTunes, Audio Boom, or Libsyn. Class is always in session on social media if you're a Filmlosophan. That's right, we made up a word and we're proud of it.
Yeah, why not?
Be sure to like the show on Facebook, facebook.com/Filmlosophers, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/Filmlosophy101. Comment on recent movie news and share your input on our latest review, not yours.
I mean, you can share yours too.
Exactly.
We'll comment on yours if you comment on ours.
Share your input to see on our latest review episodes anytime, day or night. Finally, to see a full lineup of previous episodes and access other podcasts in the VGB Studios network, do yourself a favor and visit vgbstudios.com. I am having a little bit of trouble, but I
know
okay.
You're just so excited. You're talking over yourself.
Exactly.
It's like you're saying the next word at the same time that you're saying this word.
I have double vision. I can't help it. Double, not devil vision.
I was going to say that sounded.
But of course, before we get into any part of our show, we hit the movie news section. And at the very top.
And the drama continues. You want me to take over?
No. At the top of our news, Henry Cavill teases a black Superman suit for Zack Snyder's Justice League. So even if you haven't seen Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice quite yet, Henry Cavill has been posting on-set and workout pics from Justice League on Instagram. And the Warner Brothers panel at Comic-Con revealed the Man of Steel joining the rest of DC's core pantheon. And now it looks like Superman will be getting a major costume change when he rises from the grave.
Spoiler alert.
Yep. So if you don't know...
Yeah, if you haven't seen the movie...
Nah, you know.
It doesn't end well for Superman.
Yeah.
Or does it?
There you go.
That dirt seems to tell a different story.
Cavill sported darker shades of Soup's classic red and blue suit in previous films, but based on the actor's recent Instagram post, he's going all black for Justice League. While the image is only a close-up of the chest, you can see the edge of his signature family crest on the chest plate. Rumors already begin to swirl a while back over this new look, and now it seems to be confirmed. So this has been talked about ever since the end. Obviously, spoiler alert if you haven't seen BVS, but ever since the end of that film and kind of even the way his casket looked at the end of that film, it was an all-black casket. Obviously, they're not going to do a red and blue casket. It's kind of be off. But ever since that scene, everybody speculated that, oh, they're going to go with the black-suited Superman, which, according to comic lore, that initially precedes the current events of that time.
Sure.
When he dies. So I'm kind of excited to see that because it does go into a bit more of different personalities of Superman, as does the comic after Superman initially dies and comes back to life. But I don't know.
Here's the thing. Number one, actually, I have two thoughts. The first thought is the details on these costumes are and always have been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Whoever does the costumes on the DC Cinematic Universe or Expanded, whatever they call it these days.
The DCCU.
I mean, this stuff what he posted on Instagram, it was like an extreme close-up and has all kinds of detail work in the fabric of this costume. It's amazing. You should definitely go check it out. Secondly, my fear, and hopefully after all of the conversation that's happened since Man of Steel, and especially since BVS, Dawn of Justice, hopefully all that conversation is going to result in a very positive change mm-hmm. of sorts when they get to Justice League. My fear, though, is that Spider-Man 3, Sam Raimi, mm-hmm. Spider-Man 3.
What about Black Spider-Man?
Black-suited Spider-Man.
Black jazzy.
Which was also similarly like an amazing storyline in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they made that happen in the movie, let's just say it wasn't my cup of tea. I thought it was really,
I don't think
really,
it was
really
everybody's
bad.
Cup of tea. I don't think anybody really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, the Tobey Maguire, like, pseudo-swagger, hip-hop point down the street, act like a moron thing, like, that just wasn't very good.
I'd say that's a pretty good accurate description
of it. It was really quite terrible. And I'm worried that in trying to change too many things, this might be one of those things that they're changing that they didn't have to.
Yeah.
We'll have to see. I mean, all we have is one little glimpse of a costume. So who knows?
And if history has served us well, when it comes to Zack Snyder and having either himself or somebody else promote an upcoming work that he's going to be doing, say, for instance, with Batman versus Superman, having that actor who was in Man of Steel come out and say that quote from
The Dark Knight Returns,
mm-hmm. and to give everybody this false hope that it's going to be that storyline to get this, we're getting a similar kind of event where Henry Cavill is coming out and showing something where people are leaning towards one side, hoping that this is what they're going to get. And my fear is, in actuality, it's going to be kind of like a ripoff of the suit, just only, and everything else kind of still be in the Snyder universe.
Well, it's interesting because the dynamic here is very odd. We've talked many times before about how when you translate something from one format to another, we even talked about it on last week's episode, when you translate from a book to a film, mm-hmm. Or a stage play to a film or whatever, there are choices that need to be made about what's going to work well in the format that you're doing the story. So I think we should all have learned by now, if you're taking elements directly from famous comic book stories, you're not going to get a like panel by panel recreation of the comic book on film. It wouldn't work. Even Watchmen, which Zack Snyder did and tried in many ways to replicate a panel by panel experience, mm-hmm. there were certain things that didn't translate well into the medium of film.
Yeah.
And so you have to be careful about managing your expectations given what you've seen. And especially given what we've seen with this franchise up until this point, hasn't necessarily paid it off.
It's true. Well, we'll see. Next on the list is Guillermo del Toro's Cold War fantasy drama, The Shape of Water, begins filming.
You just put this on here so you could say his name.
Oh, I am fascinated with this man. I
know you are.
This man is just, this is somebody.
He's your BFF.
Oh, heck yeah.
If your brother from another mother?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a little older, I know, but
he's quite older. Yeah, well. Guillermo del Toro began working on the script for The Shape of Water while making Pacific Rim, and as works like Crimson Peak and The Strain consumed his attention, the director's fantasy project lingered in the shadows of Hollywood until now. While it's all still very mysterious, Fox Searchlight announced the start of production today, confirming the main cast, which is comprised of Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, and Richard Jenkins, and a few small plot details. All we know officially about The Shape of Water is this brief cryptic logline. The Shape of Water is an otherworldly story set against the backdrop of Cold War era America circa 1963, a mysterious and magical journey from Guillermo del Toro.
What's his name again?
Guillermo del Toro. That man, just so much elegance in the name.
I do believe that was four mentions of the name.
Might have been.
So
is it like one of those?
You're having a good day.
Oh, yeah. So del Toro's, this project has been in the works for the last, what seems to be 10 years right now going on.
As was Crimson Peak. Before, I mean, like he's got, I mean, he's a premier director in in his genre, especially, mm-hmm. and probably, I mean, you could say in Hollywood overall,
yeah.
he may not be like James Cameron premiere or Steven Spielberg premiere, but he's getting there.
Yeah.
And so as such, he's got probably another 15 projects in various stages of development that either he started or somebody else started and he took, you know, he developed a passion for and said, yes, this script that you wrote, I want to see this through. I mean, there are several that he's done over the years. Pacific Rim was one that he had in mind, had sort of started working on, and it took, I don't know how many years, probably a decade there.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Crimson Peak, this is another one. So it's nice to see that he now has the access to resources and the creative freedom to explore these things, because as everyone knows, when you take a creative genius and you let them percolate on something for a while, more often than not, it actually comes out really great.
Oh yeah. And the one thing with Del Toro's works in his previous past, every single one of them has seemed to be either so iconic that they become a cult classic, or they've become almost like love letters to the specific genres that they're in. You take films like Kronos, which is a love letter to vampire films and things of that sort. You take Hellboy, which is his love for comics and horror comics in that aspect. You take Pan's Labyrinth, which is his love letter to children's stories. I really enjoy seeing everything that he brings to the table every time he creates another film. And I haven't seen him do any type of war film in any aspect other than Pan's Labyrinth, which is, mind you, it's a story that in the backdrop is the Spanish War that is going on at the
time.
Well,
I mean, again, this is also a backdrop. Like, the story is probably not likely to revolve around that particular element
That
much. If it's an otherworldly story, then that just happens to be the setting of the story. And it's interesting because, you know, you talk about him playing on, you know, riffing off of all these genres. I think more than that, so similar to the way that we've seen Tim Burton over the years, he actually is just creating a genre of his own. He has a signature visual style. They're all kind of in the same, even though you have elements that maybe are, you know, more skewing towards children's fairy tales or monster movies or whatever. I mean, it's all fairly similar, but not in a boring way. It's not like, oh, this guy's a hack and he keeps doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
He actually is developing a style of his own, and, you know, similar to a Hitchcock or a Nolan, like another 15, 20 years from now, I mean, you're going to have the Del Toro, like, pantheon of films. So, you know, I mean, it's interesting to see that he does choose things with different subject matters, which is nice.
Yeah.
And then he gives it that flavor that's distinctively his.
I think one of the great things that Guillermo del Toro always brings.
That's five.
That,
for those of you keeping score.
For those of you keeping score at home, that is five. And this is six. Guillermo del Toro. I think one of the great things that he continues to bring every time he comes to bring something to the silver screen, it's a lot of his heart. I mean, you can tell from interviews that I've seen with him, from articles that I've seen written about him, it always seems to irk him. It always seems to bug him whenever something doesn't pan out. Like, for the longest time, he's been wanting to do that H.P. Lovecraft From the Mountain of Madness. He's been wanting to do that for the longest, and it's never been able to get greenlit. And I've read in articles, he talks about it so passionately, and they talk about how he gets so downtrodden when he gets to the part where he talks about how it can't seem to get off the ground with any studio. And so, and even with when he was offered the position to do the directing work for The Hobbit, he was actually given the chair to do that until Peter Jackson came back
to the franchise. Yeah.
I think that's one of the
things. Which they've been friends for years years and still have collaborated on all that stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't like a under the rug kind of deal. It was just, you know. But this is the thing with him. I love the fact that he brings not only his mindset and his creative mind and his creative thoughts, but he brings a lot of his heart. He brings a lot of what people still wish to see in film nowadays. Not that they don't, but that he really throws a lot of himself into every single one of his films. And I actually appreciate and I respect that.
Well, and it's kind of like what's really popular in culture in general right now, that whole handcrafted approach. I mean, he's a craftsman. He's not just cashing a paycheck, which
no,
some
no
some
way.
even though it's a creative enterprise, everybody actually does put a lot of passion into their project. Sometimes the studios tie your hands more often than others. And depending on your level of skill and or the length of your expertise in the industry as a whole, you may not have as many freedoms to do things the way that you want to do them. You just have to follow what the studio execs are telling you. But I think for him, he's always found ways to really display craftsmanship in the work that he does. Even his earlier works that were more studio driven, like yeah. less creative freedom because he wasn't established yet. He still found ways to put that like love of the medium of film mm-hmm. and his particular relationship to the medium of film as one of the nuances of the films that he's been part of a large team collaborating to make.
True.
You know, it's never just one person making a movie.
And, you know, we'll keep you posted on anything else that comes up from that. But that does bring us to our main topic of the day, and that is the making of a summer blockbuster.
DJ Jazzy Jeff?
That's right. We're talking about films that, you know what, really highlighted what our summer, pretty much a lot of our summers were filled with. I know mine personally, I spent hours upon hours upon days upon weeks at the movie theaters.
Yeah. So, you did.
I did. I kid you not.
And not simply watching the movies, but standing in line waiting for the movies, mm-hmm. talking to people after the movies, doing this podcast.
True.
You've had a movie-ful summer.
That is true. And so, and obviously when you talk about summertime, you got to bring in Summertime by the Fresh Prince himself. And come on.
It's one of those bittersweet moments, you know, hearing this song, because it kind of is bringing home to me that summer really is ending. Summer is my favorite season of the year. I love the sunshine. I love swimming pools.
Mm-hmm.
I love summer movies. I haven't been to as many as you have. But I've been to a lot more than usual.
Yeah.
So it's hard to bid it farewell and to embrace the autumn.
Tis
of things.
True. We are standing upon the rail as we wave summer goodbye.
Although Oscar season's coming up, and that makes me happy too in a different way. So
that is true.
You know, trade-offs.
Yes, we're talking about the makings of a summer blockbuster. The hottest months of the year tend to bring some of the biggest Hollywood films. So that brings the discussion to the table for us, the Filmlosophers, summer blockbusters. So to be technical, let's take a quick look at the definition of the term blockbuster. An unusually successful hit with widespread popularity and huge sales, especially a movie or play or recording or novel.
Which is really interesting to me that it's kind of defined in retrospect,
mm-hmm.
because for years now, it's been kind of defined by studios more aspirationally, more as like a hopeful, like, this is a blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
So everybody needs to go see it, right?
And be prepared for the blockbuster hit of the summer.
Right, exactly. It's part of the marketing technique to kind of predictively establish the movie, whereas really at its core, it's a term that means, hey, wow, you just did something amazing and highly uncommon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Typically, a blockbuster is a fabulous summer movie that audiences line up to see the first week and it's released. Or if you're like us, we tend to see it either the week before, or if we're really hyped up about a movie, we'll see it the Thursday before, because we here in Sacramento.
And if we're really, really hyped up, we'll go see it multiple times.
Several times in a weekend. So when studios describe a film as a blockbuster, it's usually implied that the film will be released during the summer months, which, mind you, it's still really ambiguous as far as where the summer blockbuster season ends and begins and where Oscar season begins and ends. There it's still really high up in the air, but so far what really has kind of laid the groundwork for most of summer blockbusters are the films that are released between May and August.
Yeah, kind of in general, for the last few decades, let's say, has followed, generally speaking, the traditional school calendar.
Yeah.
So before there were a large number of year-round schools and other alternative formats, you know, school would let out around end of May, early June, and then go back in session
mm-hmm.
shortly before Labor Day. And so anything in between there, kids are on summer break, families are going on vacation, people are spending money, and so let's put these big movies out there.
Oh, yeah.
Now they're actually skewing on all across the spectrum because, well, it's a crowded marketplace as far as studios trying to get really expensive movies into the theater at a time when people are spending money. So now they're looking into earlier May, like later in August, early September. Now they're starting to push into even the springtime just to find a section of time real estate where maybe unexpectedly a film, say Deadpool, might do really well. You know, traditionally you'd think that that's expensive and should be released during the summer to have any hope of making back its budget. They released it in February and the rest is history, at least to this point, because it did really well there.
And as Chad pointed out, I did spend a lot of my summer. So just to give you kind of a little bit more backstory, I actually spent a lot of my summers at the movie theaters where we were at in, I grew up in San Antonio. There was a theater that had $1.50 movies. Now, during the week, if you went before 2 o'clock, the movies were actually 50 cents. So I could essentially, for $5, see a lot of movies.
And this is a mentality, actually, just for everyone who doesn't know Eddie personally. This is something that carries over in interesting ways into the present day, because oftentimes now we're able to see movies on press credentials, during preview screenings. No money is exchanged, which is great.
Nope.
But that that sensitivity to the time on the watch is like firmly in place. So you can tell that this man, when he was growing up, he used to know that he needed to get there extra early, because by golly, if you have secured press passes, which means you can walk into that movie a minute before it starts and you have a seat to sit in, that man is asking you at 2:30 in the afternoon where the heck you are. When you have a full-time job.
It is true. Right? I have bugged Chad several times over.
It's definitely ingrained in your mentality, which is, you know, it's good. I mean, it means we're going to definitely be there. We're going to show up because you're holding the spot if need be.
That's true. I've held the spots for the whole crew, actually, at times for several different movies.
And you have a whole crew of folks that you hang out with.
That's true.
While you're holding the spot. So it all works out.
Yep. Pretty much everybody in this room. Social time. And a couple other folks.
Little movie theater play date.
Yep. We got Mr. Fly on the Wall over here. Corey Vincent usually attends with me as well, and Chad as well for the show and so forth. So, but yeah, I mean, we've spent a lot of time during the summer and so forth. So going back to the term summer blockbuster, so we've defined blockbuster, but where does the word summer blockbuster come from? Where does the word blockbuster in itself come from? The term actually began to appear in the American press in the early 1940s, referring to aerial bombs capable of destroying a whole block or streets. Later, the term began to be used to refer to successful theater plays, hit movies, best-selling novels, and computer games. So eventually, as the time continued to move forward from the initial war era where stuff like that happened, the bombs and so forth, it began to move out of the negative connotation and begin to move to a more positive connotation.
In marketing, we call that repurposing.
There you go.
You repurpose the term. Sort of like the word cops to describe police. It used to be extremely derogatory, and then they kind of took ownership of it and transformed. Of course, nowadays, you know, we're not going to have that conversation, but you know, there was definitely a change, a shift in how people saw the term. This is a similar term. Blockbuster used to be related to warfare and devastation. And now we think about like really popular movies that most people tend to like.
Yeah. And in film, a number of terms were used to describe a hit. In the 1970s, these included spectacular, which was coined by the Wall Street Journal, super grosser, which was coined by the New York Times, and super blockbuster, which was coined by Variety. In 1975, the usage of blockbuster for films coalesced around Steven Spielberg's Jaws and became perceived as something new, a cultural phenomenon, a fast-paced, exciting entertainment, almost a genre altogether in itself. Audiences interacted with such films, talked about them afterwards, and went back to see them again just for the thrill. So, essentially, what's known in cinema history is that Jaws was the first essential summer blockbuster, to be quoted as. So, when that phrase was spoken, we're not too sure who first used it for the film, but the term summer blockbuster pretty much became synonymous with Jaws during that entire era during the 70s.
Which makes sense because it wasn't expected to do as well as it did.
It was a
pleasant surprise, which I think is a far cry from how we use the term today. Sometimes it still works, but usually we have to find a different term then to describe a movie that we thought wasn't going to do very well that did really, really well. It's not a blockbuster. It's, I don't know what it is. It's something else. Because everybody expects a big movie to be a blockbuster.
Yeah, and with a lot of the promotions and a lot of the marketing from a lot of studios and so forth, you would almost expect every film that would come out during that summertime to be a blockbuster hit or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, and studios need it.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean,
yeah.
If they're going to recoup their costs, they kind of just, they need to prime that pump and they need to get people thinking in that direction because otherwise they lose a lot of money.
And mind you, ladies and gentlemen, we are not talking about the yellow and blue video store rental place that you remember growing up and getting excited to drive
to.
Oh,
may
it
rest in peace.
RIP Blockbuster, hashtag always and forever.
I did visit that store a lot.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
And I did the little mail-in deal where they would send you and then you'd return it and they'd send you more and you just had this queue that kept, and now we have Netflix and it's right there on your computer.
That's true. Yeah, we spent way too much time at our Blockbuster. Our Blockbuster knew us by name. We were going, like, when Thursday would hit, because Thursday and Friday were technically the beginning of the weekend for us, we would go Thursday, we would rent a movie for Thursday, bring it back on Saturday. If we had time, we would get another movie on Saturday to watch for the weekend on Sunday, and then return it either Sunday night or Monday night. And, yeah, the two-day rentals were not our friend, because those usually were the recent releases, and it would take us forever to return them.
Oh, you got extra fines, huh?
Oh, yeah, always. So, what are some defining traits of a summer blockbuster?
Explosions. Famous people,
yeah.
Exotic locations.
Am
I close?
Not even. Since 1975, the genres of 48% of the blockbusters have been action films.
See, I was close. Explosions.
Yeah.
Right on the money.
Since 2000, the amount of summer films that are based on comic books have hiked exponentially, going from 2% of the films to more than 35%. I wonder
why that
is. As a comic
book guy, I think that's amazing.
You know,
I love it.
And since we mentioned the year 2000, what kind of started that off the following year? X-Men.
Well, X-Men was in 2000.
Was it? I thought it was 2001.
I'm pretty sure it was 2000, yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, it started the whole modern resurgence of it. Obviously, there was, you know, the original Batman films were before that, had started before that, and all happened by the 90s, but they kind of had already died down, and then it was time to reinvigorate the genre, and things took off from there, because shortly thereafter, then you also had Spider-Man from Sony.
Yeah.
And then...
When was the Tobey Maguire trilogy? Was that in the
90s? No, it was after, it was 2002, I want to say. It started Memorial Day, I think, of 2002.
You're right, because I remember seeing the
Memorial Day
first
weekend, and it was huge. It was an enormous, enormous take for that movie. That was a blockbuster.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we can say that one of the defining traits of a summer blockbuster has pretty much action written all over it. I mean, if it's an action film, then we know that it's more than likely been released during that summer season.
In many cases,
in most
and oftentimes the action things, the stunts and the explosions and the CGI and all that, that's what costs a lot of money to make versus like a dramatic scene, even with two very famous people, is tens of millions of dollars less than an action sequence in most blockbustery type films.
Let me ask you a quick question, since we're still on the subject of comic book action films. Because of the very, very much, you know, escalated increase in the percentage of how many of the summer films are comic book films, do you think there's becoming like an oversaturation of comic book films to where it seems like even people are not that they're obscure? So just a disclaimer, I'm not, you know, knocking any franchise or any whatever. I'm just throwing the question out there. Do you think that we're starting to get to a point to where people are just wanting to throw any comic book out onto the silver screen just so that they can say, oh, by the way, we got this one who happened to be a part of the Marvel Universe at one point in time. It's little guy from, you know, the 1970s, you know, whatever, or something ridiculous. Do you think that we're getting to that kind of a point with
So film? I think that especially in the media, there's this almost this eagerness for that moment to hit where people just get tired of it. And inevitably someday it's going to hit. People are going to be tired of comic book adaptation films and they're going to want something different, something that feels new, even if that's a resurgence of cowboy films, you know, Wild Wild West or something. Not the Will Smith movie, but the Frontier.
We just did Summertime. I'm not going back that way.
So eventually, yeah, it'll turn over. It'll become something else. Maybe it'll be rom-coms again or period pieces with historic significance or whatever it is. I don't think we've gotten there yet. And the beautiful thing about drawing from comic books is that you have a very, very deep bench of stories that are already structured to be visual. It's a visual medium, although it's on the page. So you kind of already get a sense of what characters look like and how they move and how they relate to one another and all that, their settings and everything. So you've got a very deep bench of content from different authors, illustrators, you know, artists, publishing houses, etc. It's not even, it's more robust than if you were to say, oh, well, if we decided that Shakespeare was a genre, then we have however many plays to draw from. So that's going to keep us going for years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, take that and multiply it by like 50,000. And that's the potential that you have. Now, are comic books like Shakespeare? No, they're not equivalent, but there's just a lot more to pull from in them. And like we said before, you're not going to adapt it directly.
Yeah.
Exactly from the page to the screen. So the choices that you make, you have different recombinations of characters and themes and whatever that you can do. Similar to a book. They say with something like The Bourne Identity, for example, the book was much more action-oriented, your typical spy story. The movie went more existential with him trying to struggle through who he was or might be because he didn't know, you know. So you make tonal choices as well when you adapt it into a different medium. So I think it can go on for a while still before the mass mainstream truly gets tired of it.
Another defining trait of a summer blockbuster is the unique violence increase.
Explosions.
Yes. Subtly called the Marvel curve, the amount of violence, even when in a comic book based film, has increased dramatically in the last 16 years from explosions. You're supposed to say explosions.
Oh, explosions.
To shootouts. The amount of violence displayed on the silver screen has risen to new heights. Even the amount of murders displayed in summer blockbusters has risen from 39% in 2005 to over 60% today. And that's just in the summer films. Now, we had stated the unique violence increase. The unique part about it, the amount of blood displayed in these films has actually stayed pretty settled. From hitting a high in 2000 at 40%, we have actually...
Thank you, Gladiator.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Gladiator. Also 2000.
We have dropped and have stayed relatively still around 32% since 2005.
So that's 32% of the deaths or...
Blood
or
chunk.
Violence in a movie involves bloodshed.
That's just blood being displayed on camera itself.
So it could be a fist fight.
Could
be a Quentin Tarantino movie.
That's pretty much every Tarantino movie. So what does that
Quentin
mean?
Quentin Tarantino movies are 27% of that 32%.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Interesting, though, because, yes, is the violence, there's more violence more of the time because you have budgets that can handle it. But I think of things like Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
That had a huge amount of destruction.
It did.
And presumed death. Didn't have a lot of blood.
No.
You know, but it, so you've got, I mean, it's been around since before comic book movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you think of like films like, what brings to mind for me is the first Iron Man film. When he's testing out those rockets that he has on his shoulders and he's fighting those, I guess the terrorist, whomever
right.
is, I'm not going to, you know, quote.
I think
thinking.
It's a made up country anyway.
So those
I can't
people
remember off the top of my head, but yeah.
But I do remember him shooting like when they're holding their guns on these people who are there, and he shoots out all these little rockets from his shoulders, and it shoots every single one of them, and they just go down, and it's like, so they got shot, but there was no blood, and mind you, not that I was looking for gore and violence or whatever in it, but the unique thing about it is. We get to, you know, see, we get to a point to where Hollywood is now showing us bloodless murders. So we're pretty much getting to where there's like a sanitization of violence in Hollywood. So we're getting a lot more cleaner deaths. Apparently, we're getting a lot more instances where murder is I guess, almost okay to see as long as you do it in the right light of you know, good versus evil, things like that. You don't actually see.
Well, and it's interesting because entertainment has always had a thing with how you portray even just fighting. I mean, you go back to an old Western film, right? And you've got stage choreography. It's obvious that our hero didn't hit the villain that hard, but suddenly he's knocked out.
Yeah.
Or one guy gets, you know, one villain gets stabbed in the side and he dies immediately, but another guy who's more heroic gets stabbed in the heart and he has like a 10-minute monologue.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you've had it for generations where there's not an equivalence of the type of violence being done versus the effect that it's having on somebody. But, yeah, I think that you get into the mentality. A lot of movies try to mimic also the appearance of, like, video game play. And sometimes with video games, you have a similar feel because you as the playable character, you're moving so fast that there's no need to display a whole, you know, massive amount of what happens to the characters that you're taking out while you're moving around. And then you've got your Mortal Kombat's of the world that, like, it's splashing on the screen at you.
Get over here. All that good stuff. That was funny.
I know. I'm like, I of course, I'm going to bring a reference from, you know, the 90s or something, but still,
you brought a reference to video games, and we have an official video game historian over here who's just looking at us like these idiots.
He's zoned out. He's not listening to us anymore.
No, he's not.
He doesn't like listening to us.
He doesn't like it all.
Move on.
He's shaking his head.
Sanitized violence.
One last thing that also is a defining trait of a summer blockbuster, we feel, are end credit scenes and sequels. You know, more and more often these have become synonymous with Marvel films, obviously because of the fact that everybody expects to see that final end credit scene, the moment where you see Samuel L. Jackson come out and say, you know, want you to join my team for the Avengers initiative, whatever, or you see, you know, you pretty much see the things that you were hoping to see, whether if it's Spider-Man at the end of the scene, you know, messing with his web shooter, or it's Iron Man talking to General Ross in a bar, or if it's, you know, Agent Coulson finding Thor's hammer, Mjolnir, in the middle of a desert. Marvel and end credit scenes have become one and the same.
Absolutely, yeah. This is totally a Marvel thing. I mean, it's happened in other movies before.
Oh, yeah.
But it's totally the stamp of a Marvel movie.
And many people believe that one of the first films to incorporate an end credit scene was the 1980s comedy Airplane. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, in all honesty, that honor actually goes to the first film actually utilizing scenes being played during the credits. The honor goes to the 1941 iconic classic film Citizen Kane. Not many people know that because of the fact that at the end of the film, there is a scene that's going on while the end credits are going down the screen.
Sure.
And there's still stuff to pay attention to, which essentially is still an end credit scene.
Anyway, it's a during credits scene, but yeah, we'll give it to him. I mean, it's Citizen Kane. You're not gonna argue against that. It's like one of the behemoths of Hollywood.
Yeah,
history.
And you know, you got films like in the 1986 sci-fi film, you got Aliens, which actually also is another film that came after that I remember actually that came after Airplane that had another very interesting end credit scene. That was also another one that really came out. And even Wayne's World. I don't know if you remember 1992's Wayne's World.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I mean, you've got quite a few that do it
for laughs. And, you know, it's not setting up anything to follow.
Yeah.
Versus with Marvel, they've done it intentionally to set up something that comes next.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a little, you know, bow tied onto the end of the movie just for kicks.
Yeah.
You know, it's always setting up something next. And I would argue with the Marvel, maybe, I don't know what you call it, the business plan, the strategy, they're not so much limiting themselves to sequels. They're building an entire mega franchise with multiple franchises within it. So what they're doing with their connected cinematic universe is actually different than anything that we've seen before in the medium of film, where you would have, say, your Indiana Jones that wants to set up a trilogy, or your Star Wars or whatever that wants to set up multiple films in one through line. Obviously, Star Wars is bigger than that now. But with Marvel, they went in knowing that they wanted to set up multiple through lines in one interconnected universe of movies.
Yeah.
So they treated it differently, and this is a nice small touch that they've applied to all of their films so far, either a mid-credits or an end-credits or both,
mm-hmm.
Just to really hammer home that point, that these are all connected and the story's not over. Come back in 3 months, 1 year, 6 months, 9 months, whatever it is. Come back and watch the next installment in this universe.
And it's interesting that you talk about sequels because, like we said, one of the defining traits we feel is obviously end credit scenes and sequels. Since 2010, more than half of the blockbuster films were, in fact, sequels. Over 50% now seem to be sequels. So why is that? A lot of people, like you said, a lot of people are asking that same question. You know, what is the purpose of continuing to create sequels and promote them during the summertime, during that blockbuster season? And I feel, you know, it is a very high revenue point for a lot of studios to decide, okay, when is the time that our market is most available and most willing to pay money to be entertained? And sure. you look at the summer season, and it's prime for that because of the fact that you're putting out a property that is originally geared for kids because you have comics and the cartoons, and you display that, you know what, we're going to be showing, we're going to be releasing, you know, Captain America Civil War during this time, blah, 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 and that you should come and see it. And they're like, okay, the kids are out of school, we have time, we can go see it, and we can all put the money in, as opposed to, well, the kids got to go to bed, this, this, and that, or oh, I have to do this in the morning, or however it is. The summertime seems to be the preferred season for a lot of studios to really push, I feel, a lot of their sequels, like this past summer that we've experienced. You know, we had the Independence Day sequel. We had the third part to the Captain America films, Civil War.
Dawn of Justice, in a way.
It just seems to be the marketing strategy for
sequels. Well, and here's the thing. Sequels, while you can still call some films, like, for example, Now You See Me 2. That is a sequel.
Tis true.
In a technical sense, Captain America Civil War is a sequel, but it doesn't have the same feel because it's not Captain America 3 Civil War. I think that a lot of what Hollywood is starting to do is to take a cue from the new golden age of television and say, okay, television is telling really, really great stories mm-hmm. in a serialized format, which is episodic. You know, you have however many episodes in a season, 8 or 10 or... if you're a network show, maybe 20. But they're looking at the great storytelling ability of a TV show, and they're trying to now bring that kind of a feel into the movies, because movies started to feel, let's say 10 years ago, you started to have this feeling of, oh, everything's a sequel or a reboot.
Yeah.
And so where's the creativity in that? And that it became a very true negative statement on Hollywood, which is primarily a giant creative enterprise, well, primarily a business, but secondarily a giant creative enterprise, and it was an indictment of the principles of the entire industry. So people took it very seriously within, you know, closed walls and said, okay, we've got to make the creativity like very, very apparent again. And so you still do get sequels. Now You See Me Too. It's not yet an established franchise, but then you also get Captain America Civil War, which I would say is just happens to be the next episode in a much larger story than even just the Captain America set of 3 or 4 or 5 films that they will eventually have with Chris Evans in the lead role.
Yeah.
You know, you've got all of those properties working together. It's one very large story that's much bigger than the term sequel, prequel, threequel. You know, it's something different. It's a new animal we haven't seen before.
Yeah. So those are some of the defining traits we feel. I mean, there are a couple of other things we have. One of the defining traits are surprise endings. 30% of blockbusters since 2010 have had surprise endings. You have the unique logo changes, like the logo changes you saw with Harry Potter's and the Deathly Hallows, or Suicide Squad for more recent example, how the pink and green and yellow and so forth. The logo for, you know, their studios. The very first film to actually promote an altered version of the studio logo was actually the Flintstones, the 1994 Flintstones movie,
mm-hmm.
which had, you know, The Rock and all these formations of the
live action.
Yeah, the live action with John Goodman. Wilma, yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Rick Moranis.
Yes.
Rosie O'Donnell. Halle Berry.
Halle Berry,
I remember
that's right.
her. That was one of the first
I
movies that
you
I was
do remember
you know,
her.
Aware of her.
Just kidding. Another thing that is a quick defining thing is the father-son relationships. The most common relationship in the summer blockbusters by far are the father-son relationships, taking over 30% of summer films. So those are some of the
Thank
things.
Thank you, Darth Vader.
Tis true. Those are some of the things that we see as defining traits. Now, what is the one thing that makes a summer blockbuster so unique? Above anything else, one of the things, I mean, beyond the conversations, beyond anything else, beyond the Marvel...
Explosions.
You know, whatever, beyond the explosions, I think the more pertinent and more, I guess, elephant in the room kind of deal when it comes to summer blockbusters are the fact that they are constantly snubbed by the Oscars.
In the big categories.
In the big
Usually
categories.
They'll get like a little bit of a shoe-in for
yeah,
visual effects.
They'll get
or
the little tidbit. They'll get like
the
little
sometimes like
the scraps.
Score.
But we're looking at like best actress, best actor,
best
you know,
director,
best
picture,
exactly.
Yeah. So, best cinematography.
One of the biggest oddities, if you will, about summer films are that they are tentatively closer than the first portion of the year to the start of Oscar voting season. But they tend to be overlooked more times than most. For example, out of the last two decades, so we're talking since 2016 to 1996, or vice versa, 1996
yep, the other
to
way around, but I'm with you.
Only four films released during the months of May and August ever won Best Picture.
May through August,
yeah. Which are our summer yeah. blockbuster season. So you got in 2009, June of 2009, you got The Hurt Locker. We go back to... May of 2006, you got Crash.
Okay.
You got in May of 2000, you have Gladiator, which we were just mentioning a little
that's
bit ago.
Favorite movie ever. Amazing.
And then the last one on the docket for...
It should win Best Picture again.
It should, just because it is. And then the last one is in the 1996 Oscars, you have Braveheart.
Which released... Summer of 95.
Which released summer 95
won
and then
the Oscar
Oscars
in
for 96.
Yeah.
So out of two decades, that's 20 years for those of you who don't really know what a decade is. For 20 years, summer blockbusters have only been able to win four really solid, well-known, more notable Oscars. So that kind of, to me, seems to be a little bit of a criminal act for me because you take, what was it, 2 years ago or a year ago, you had Inside Out.
Sure.
Inside Out definitely was one of the top films that could have possibly got Best Picture for me in my mind, because it was such a very deep and thought-provoking type of film as a cartoon, go figure. And even this year, when was Zootopia released?
It was earlier. It was springtime.
Well,
just before the summer season.
Yeah, you know, Disney seems to really pull on the heartstrings when they really release a lot of their films. And that was one of them that I felt it should have at least got a lot more Oscar attention than it did. And because of the fact that it was a summer release, it didn't really.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you've got to keep in mind, too, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. So summer blockbusters have a lot of marketing dollars already spent on them to get butts in the seats in a theater. The Oscar type film, if there is such a beast, that gets a lot of behind the scenes money put
there's
behind
a beast.
It. To essentially go through like an election process. So you have to qualify to win an Oscar, Golden Globe, People's Choice, whatever. You have to qualify to be nominated. And in order to qualify, you do a campaign very similar to a political campaign with people who are part of Screen Actors Guild, Directors Guild, right, whatever, all of that. And so there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff and studios have to devote dollars to doing that. They don't want to do that typically with blockbuster type films because they've already invested so much money just to get it out the gate and to try to get an audience.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. There's a game that goes on behind the scenes.
It is.
But I think that to your point, there definitely are some summer films that have done really well that should have gotten more love from awards programs over the years than they have.
That's true. And speaking of films that need to get love, that actually brings us to our special segment. That is our top five list. Yes, we're talking about summer blockbusters going on right now, and the filmlosophers enjoy spending as much of their waking summer minutes as possible watching great summer hits. So we decided we would break it down on the best ones we've seen this summer. Here's the filmlosophers' top five summer films of 2016. So we're gonna kind of go through the gauntlet real quick, and we got five spots. Mind you, they're in no specific order, but they are five spots that we kind of feel like, you know what, they're notable enough to place a film that we actually each hold in high regard from the summer for these specific genres. So we're gonna kind of go from the start, from the top, and let's go ahead and start with our first category.
Give me the category.
Our first category is family.
I'll take family for 200, Alex.
By all means, take it.
You want me to give my vote?
Sure.
Finding Dory, hands down. Flippers down.
I don't know. That one was okay. It was good, but I don't think it outranks the BFG for me.
So before you stepped on my moment, I was going to say the reason why I think it was such a phenomenal
you
film.
You don't get a moment now.
I know. You told it. You totally took it. Also, I didn't even see the BFG.
That's okay.
So there's no point of comparison for me. So I still vote for Finding Dory, flippers down. The reason being that we've seen Pixar do it very poorly with Cars 2 in terms of
sequels.
A sequel using a side character. We talked about this before in our review. I thought that this one, it had a lot of heart, had a lot of warmth, introduced some new animation style elements. There were some very photorealistic looking things in the film. And I mean, who's going to not love that whole big group of otters blocking traffic with their cuddle time? I mean, come on now.
I would say the people who had to swerve out of the way to not hit him.
Well, but that was the plan. You needed to get him to stop and swerve and whatever. So,
my vote, obviously, I've already
stepped on my
it.
Moment.
I stepped on his
yeah.
moment.
Yeah, we covered that.
I shall drink your tears later. was the BFG, and because of the fact that the BFG, which is a Roald Dahl based film, based on one of his novels, I was a huge fan of the novel. I was a huge fan of all his works, of his stories, of his books, and so forth. And so when it came to the adaptation of this film, we've already had a horrific adaptation with the Willy Wonka film, the one with Johnny Depp, and that was horrendous. That was just bad. If you want a little bit more insight on that, there's actually a blog of it on the VGBstudios.com website where I talk about the top seven films, I believe, that top seven reboots that should not have been made, and that is actually one of them. So when it came to coming into this one, I was a little bit more cautious, but when I actually saw the film and saw how closely it stuck to the actual story of, the BFG and how it, it referenced back to the actual book itself.
So it gave you all the feels.
It gave me all the feels. Mind you, okay, I do have to give that Baby Dory is the cutest thing in the world.
Oh, like, no, don't try to give me my moment back at this point.
The moment is gone. I'm just making, So the next one.
You took Baby Dory in your hand and, I can't even say it.
Sushi. Next one on our list is action. And we're not talking about, it's not comic related. So you can't pick, your Captain America's or your.
Of course.
Your
the hatred continues. The
BVS.
The stepping on of moments keeps going on. So non-comic book related action movie.
Yes.
That's a hard one because there haven't been all that many. Most of the movies this summer that are truly action oriented were somehow connected to comics.
I can give you mine if you want.
I think that, okay, go ahead.
Just to give you a little bit more time to think if you
want.
Yeah,
I mean, I already know what I'm going to say, but you go for it.
You know what? That's two for two.
I know. I don't trust you. That's why I'm having you go first. I don't trust you to not step on my moment. So you speak.
Mine was, so far, action was a little skimpy as far as not comic related in the summer months, but there was a film that actually kind of held its own when it came to this particular genre, and it was Warcraft. Warcraft actually did really well for me. It was long, but it had a lot of substance to it, and in the end, I actually enjoyed the film. I could have gone the route of the one that you're not too happy about, which was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, gosh. But we're all lucky that you didn't go that route.
But go ahead.
Yeah, Warcraft was better than I expected it to be. I didn't know a whole lot about that whole genre or franchise, whatever you want to call it. I've never played the games, and that's why we brought in some special help when we reviewed it.
Just true.
I liked the illustration, the computer animation and everything. It had some weaknesses to it. most of the films this summer kind of did, but yeah. My vote is for Jason Bourne. Part of that is the nostalgia factor. I love spy movies. I love them. And I've never known why. I'm incredibly entertained by almost every spy movie I've ever seen, even the campy ones. So I think in another life, maybe I was supposed to be a spy.
In another
but
life.
For the record, anyone from another country who's listening, I'm not. So don't step on my moment. So did it have issues? Of course it did. Leaned a lot on what we've liked about Bourne movies in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it was better than the last one that didn't have Jason Bourne in it. And I'm still really impressed with that Las Vegas Strip car chase, massive, real physical stunt scene.
Which we actually found out later on that Corey was actually in Las Vegas for it. And he was, you know, enjoying himself, watching all the craziness and whatnot of Jason Bourne destroying half the city. So that was actually really cool. But that brings us to our next one, our next category. And this Chad is going to get excited for, and I'll let him finish what he's going to say. The top franchise film of the summer.
Well, we all know what I'm going to say because I forced the film Lossifers to spend 3 episodes talking about the franchise.
And it's true.
Captain America Civil War, for me, easily best franchise movie of the summer. Comic related, of course. I loved seeing all the characters. I loved the way that they gave each of them a reason for standing where they stood across the divide.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the comedy. More than anything, was such a joy in that giant airport fight sequence. Giant Man and Spider-Man in particular being the two standouts of injecting humor into a very serious situation in a way that didn't seem hokey. I really appreciated that film. I can't wait until it comes out on DVD. I will go out the day it comes out and get it, or I'll just pre-order it on Amazon so it comes in the mailbox.
The day it comes out, huh?
Absolutely. And I will watch it that night. After we do this show, because we record on Tuesdays and movies come out on Tuesdays. So it'll be a late night for me, but I'll love it. How about you? Franchise.
Franchise. See, the problem for me is I'm super limited on franchise films because I didn't really get a chance to see as many as I wanted to. And there was a ton of them out there. I mean, you had Star Trek Beyond, which I hadn't gotten a chance to see. There was... what else? You had, obviously, the Captain America
Jason
film.
Jason Bourne, you Captain America, Dawn
of Justice. You had Alice in the Looking Glass, X-Men. But you know what? I think, actually, I have to take one of your answers, and for franchise films, I would probably have to say the Jason Bourne film. It was a good franchise film as far as following suit with the rest of the previous films. It followed a lot of the information. It followed a lot of the storyline and so forth, and it carried really well for me. So I think Jason Bourne is probably going to be my choice for that one.
Okay.
Here's a funny one here. So your top flop of the summer.
And top flop in like how well it flopped, how dramatically it flopped, or in spite of the fact that it flopped, I still thought it was great.
No, just flopped that you've seen for the summer.
For me?
Falling on your belly, straight out bad.
TMNT 2.
Really?
I could not stand that movie from the moment it started, and I loved the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as a kid. So for me, it flopped extravagantly for me.
For me, I'm probably going to have to say Independence Day Resurgence. Mm. That film really didn't deliver on any levels whatsoever that I was hoping for, and sadly, it was just bad. You know, it should have been called the...
You didn't like the giant queen alien chasing a school bus full of kids when she had something better to do? Come on.
Who doesn't?
Cinematic gold.
Last category on our list, surprise films. What was your surprise film?
This one for me was actually an easy choice. I'm going with The Legend of Tarzan.
Really?
Reason being, I didn't expect to like it at all. But I really did, and most of that is because Samuel L. Jackson was in like 70% of the movie, it felt like, at least. And I expected him to have like one of his little like cameo type roles where he sort of shows up for 5 minutes, goes away, and maybe shows up for another minute at the end. But he was actually in most of the movie, which made it really enjoyable for me.
Yeah. For me, the surprise film of the summer so far would probably have to be Ghostbusters. I actually found myself enjoying the film. I'm super nostalgic when it comes to films like Ghostbusters and you know, Monster Squad and things of the 80s. So hearing that this was getting remade, I was pretty much on the side of negativity. But after seeing the film, I can honestly say that I'd be willing to actually see it again. In fact, I plan to take my wife to go see it soon. It's a humorous movie. It's a different take. It's a fresh take on the story itself. And they deliver on all levels of humor. So
haters beware. Eddie's coming out swinging.
But that about wraps up another exciting show, The Filmlosophers. And of course, from here at VGB Studios, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.